Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios for the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, igerstudios.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with Daniel Milner. Daniel is a fabulous photographer, a great buddy, and of course the purveyor over at Smog Ranch. Daniel is a fabulous editorial photographer. He's been in the industry for years. And we're going to talk today about the situation. A great post that he put up on smogranch.com. You guys should definitely check out this resource. A great place for photographers. Daniel is also an evangelist now for Blurb. So we're going to talk to him really about photography, photographers, and what it is to be a photographer. Daniel, how's it going today?
Things are going well. Thanks for asking.
Hey, thanks for joining us here again on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program to talk about yourself, your fabulous photography, and all the great writing and insight over at Smog Ranch.
Yes, we've been sort of making a habit of doing these interviews. Actually, I like this sort of fairly regular routine. I feel like some sort of press secretary.
You're doing a great job here, and you have such a delightful insight within the industry. So I think today I want to talk about some educational opportunities that you're going to be doing based off of this conversation that we're going to have here. You had posted something on your blog over at smogranch.com about the situation.
Yeah, delightful insight. I think if you polled the audience, I'm not sure those would be the terms that people would use.
It's reality, though. I mean, it could be a sore subject to some, and I think that it's something that needs to be discussed. People need to deal with. So why don't you give us a little rundown on the situation, and then we can go from there.
Well, I think that's a good point that you made. I don't post all that often about the wedding industry, but when I do, I always get 100 times the traffic that I do when I post about other things. People ask me, man, you should write about weddings, or why don't you write about weddings all the time? And the answer is just because weddings are a tiny little part of what I have been doing. But it's not my primary focus. And the situation post, I think, first of all, it was good because it did drive a lot of traffic and it also got this conversation going. But this post was not something that I had planned out. Basically, a friend called me and said, hey, can you shoot my wedding in the summer? I said no. But I said, hang on, I'll find you a photographer because I know the area you're in. And I went online. I literally thought it would take 10 minutes to find him somebody to shoot the wedding. And I was just really surprised. I went through 31 different websites and I stopped at that point and said, wow, I think I should write something about this. I think there were people that interpreted the post the way that I was hoping, and there were others who didn't. But the thing that really, I think, basically pushed me to make sure to do posts like this in the future is there were so many people that messaged me or emailed me and said, this is what we all talk about in private, but everyone's afraid to write it. And that, to me, is such a puzzling concept of what is your blog about if you're not speaking honestly about how you feel about the industry, whether it's positive or negative. And so when I kept hearing that, I just thought, wow, this really needs to be out there. Regardless of what side of the conversation you're on or your opinion of the wedding industry, if we're not talking about it, then what's the point? I mean, what are we blogging about if we're not talking about the realities of being a photographer? People ask me all the time, hey, what sites do you read? What blogs do you follow? And unfortunately, the list is very short because I'm looking for sites that are giving me insight into what it's like to be a photographer. The good parts, the bad parts, the parts in the middle, I want everything. And that just doesn't seem to be popular these days.
Seems to be popular, though, is there's such a large pontification of BS. And I don't want to be negative towards wedding photography. And I think we're going to talk about this in a bit, but the difference in being a photographer and a craftsman. Is there a difference in a photographer and a craftsman? I think some of that stuff has been brought up on the comments on the situation. And I think this is really applicable to digital, but I think it's applicable to even guys that are shooting film. We all love film, and that's what we want to shoot, and that's my capture choice, and I know it's yours. But really, you can get into the same mess if you're shooting film as if you were being digital with the latest plugin.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, to me, there are great wedding photographers working that are shooting digital, and there are great wedding photographers that are working and shooting film. And really, the people that sort of took my post and turned it into this film versus digital thing, I think really missed the entire point. I don't really care. I mean, whatever people want to use, they're going to use. But yeah, you can sort of fall into the same trappings. It doesn't matter what technique you're using. Wedding photography kind of has a stigma attached to it. And there's a validity to that stigma in some ways. And then in other ways, it's ridiculous. When I first started in photography, I had all of my work on the same website. And I got a call from an advertising photographer that said, look, I'm trying to refer a job to you, but if this client sees weddings on your site, you are never going to get the job. I just remember thinking, whoa, like, what are you talking about? And he said, look, they're going to look at you and say, look, this guy's shooting weddings because he can't really do anything else. And I thought, man, that's ridiculous. So it is ridiculous. There's a lot of talented people in wedding field, but there is that stigma attached, and that stigma is alive and well whether we like it or not. But I think today with wedding photography, the sort of transition to digital aided in the sense that it created a lot more photographers. And it created a lot of photographers that may or may not have any background in photography who just suddenly jumped in. And there's two ways of looking at that. One, it's like, great, you have an opportunity to make a living for a lot of people that maybe loved photography and were afraid to try it before. And now it's pretty easy. You get a DSLR, autofocus. Pretty much anybody can pick that camera up and get some decent results. The downside of that is that it sort of flooded the business. And when you couple that with the fact that over the past 10 years, other genres of photography, stock, editorial, commercial, have really taken a hit in terms of being a viable, sustainable way of making a living, a lot of people have transitioned into the wedding field who would have never transitioned into the wedding field had those other genres remained healthy. And so I think that's sort of the perfect storm of people coming in. And again, I think a lot of the photographers that have sort of picked up photography in the past few years basically went online, looked at what the superstars were doing and said, okay, I'm just going to copy that. A lot of those people are very successful and they're very happy and there's absolutely nothing wrong with either of those two things. But I think photography means different things to different people. And that's where you separate the people who are really creating unique content and the people who are following. And in the wedding field, I don't see a tremendous amount of people creating unique content. I see a lot of people chasing that same theme, that same look, and that was my experience when trying to find a photographer for my friend.
So let's dive into this unique look. How do you put a unique look on a wedding? Because let's say you're a wedding photographer. Same thing, day in, day out. It's just another face stuck in that dress. It's the same thing. And you've completely given up on the wedding gig, right?
Well, I've got a wedding next year, and it looks to be a really good one, and it's a really interesting one. It was one that was very much screened for me. So it was a client talking to a certain planner who then screened the client, got the information. The client said a couple of very key things. The planner called me and said, this is what she said. I said, okay, that's really good for me. That's a good fit. So I've got one next year. But yes, for the most part, I'm done with doing weddings and portraits. I'm basically done with doing commercial photography in general. The only photography that I am hoping to continue doing is my own stuff, the documentary project. But let me go back to your first sentence when you said wedding photographer, same thing every day, just plugging in. That's where immediately I'm going in the other direction. I don't ever want the same thing. And so consequently, it comes with number one, the number of jobs that you're taking. The most weddings I ever did in a year was 12, and that was too many. So I don't look for the same thing. I don't ever want to shoot the same thing. And even when I'm shooting at a location that I've been to before, it's different because of the client. So I tailor what I'm doing and what I shoot and how I do it to the people, the location, and the taste of the people. So that dictates what I'm going to shoot, how I'm going to shoot it, or what other photographer I bring in to give me a piece of something that I need that's going to allow me to create something unique. And that takes time. It takes a lot of front-end preparation and front-end time. And that's where if you're shooting 20, 30, 40 weddings a year, it's just not possible to get that kind of personalization with each job.
With this one job that you did take based off of the planner's comments, tell me how you would accept the job or what would be different than the normal wedding gig. What made you say, I'll shoot that for you?
Well, that's funny because I always kind of think to myself, gosh, I'm not the easiest person to work with when it comes to a wedding. Because if I hear something that I don't like or it's obviously not a job for me, it's gone. And what I do is I don't just tell the client, no, sorry, I can't do that. I say, look, this isn't a good fit for me, but I'll find you a photographer that's a good fit. Because it's a lot of fun for me to take a client who's not right for me and give it to a friend who I know is going to do a great job for them and a photographer that I know is really good. So over the years, when I first started in weddings, I sort of advertised across the board. I sat down here in Southern California and I researched planners and locations and caterers and florists and all that. And I started doing mailings and I was sort of aiming wide. So say that I sent out 500 cards once every 2 months. Well, what I was doing is I would send out cards that were really strange, okay, that were really in tune with the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I guarantee you they were different than any cards that any of these people had seen. And my friends were like, what are you doing? You can't send out cards like that. And I said, yeah, I can, because this is my first screening process. So lo and behold, a handful of people called back and said, man, this is really different. Like, I haven't seen anything like this. Well, bingo, that's what I'm aiming for. I don't want the masses. I want that little niche of client that I'm looking for. So over the years, I built relationships with those people. And basically, we're strategic partners. People call me and say, look, I'm getting married. I need a planner or I need a musician or somebody. I've got these relationships with people who are all on the same page. So if a client goes to that planner, the planner's listening to what they're saying and they're taking these notes and they're saying, is this a good client for Dan or for Bill or Mary or whoever? So when a client comes to me through the planner, it's already been screened once. And so I'm doing a secondary screening and I need to hear some things and I need to show them certain kinds of work. I want to meet them. I want to talk to them. I would prefer to see where they live. I would prefer to see the books they have on the shelf. I want as much information about them as possible. If it's not a right fit, I turn it away. And I would say the vast majority of weddings that have come my way, I don't do. And it's not because the clients aren't great or the location's not great. It's just not the right fit.
Let's classify this client then. So based off of your current editorial work and what you want to shoot, what is the correct demographic for someone that you would want to invest your time in to shoot their wedding? Do you find that it's a higher educated, someone that has more of a taste in jazz and wants more of a documentary fly on the wall? I mean, what would make somebody brought to you where you would say, you know, yeah, I would like to shoot your gig? And really, the reason I ask this is if you look at the consuming population, at least in the U.S., 99.9% have no taste at all when it comes to photography, okay? So they love the mass-produced, digital, plug-in, replicated, run-of-the-mill factory photography, right? Oh, that's beautiful. Okay, great. That's what I'm trying to get at is here is what type of consumer would Daniel like to do work for based off of their tastes?
Well, I think the word sophistication gets thrown around a lot. You hear, oh, this is a more visually sophisticated client. But that's not the word I would use. I would say that my clients are more visually interested, not necessarily sophisticated. In some cases, they are. I mean, I've got clients who are artists and photographers and people that are cinematographers and motion picture people. And sure, they spend their living and their lives revolving around looking at imagery. That's the perfect client for me. But most of the time, it's just people who are more interested. They come and sit down. They're not people that go online and look through 10,000 people. They don't read the wedding magazines and the wedding publications. Most of my jobs come from, again, strategic people, whether it's another photographer, it's an artist, it's somebody at an agency, it's somebody in the art world, etc. Those are people that are coming to me, not the sort of masses of people who want to be retouched and who look like the cover of one of the women's fashion magazines where everything's just a little too perfect than what reality would ever provide. The ultimate client for me is somebody that looks at my work and says, I trust you, do what you want. And that's all I want to hear. That's the perfect thing for me. So the best clients are the ones that say, look, you are the photographer. I'm going to default to you. The people that come and say, okay, this is what you have to shoot, and here's a shot list 50 images long, and this is what we want, and blah, blah, blah. I just don't do those jobs because that's not what I do. Because frankly, when they come to me, I don't know what I'm going to shoot. So I've got to figure that out based on them and the location and their style. I did a shoot a while back. It was actually a portrait shoot here locally, and I had never met these people before, and I got referred again by one of my strategic partners in the field. And he called me and said, I think I got a great client for you. And I met these people. I walked into their house, and I just knew immediately by looking at their house, I was like, okay, this is the perfect thing for me. And then I went to their bookshelf, and I would say 2/3 of the books on their shelf are on my shelf here at home. And I said, we have the same taste, we have the same interest, et cetera. And it was just perfect. I mean, the shoot was a blast. They let me do whatever I wanted. It's great. And that's what we all want.
It's really interesting to find that you were able to connect, and when you went over there, that their tastes and your tastes match.
That was such a great surprise when you walk in and go, wow, okay, I want to be friends with these guys in addition to being a photographer for them. I want to stay in contact and be friends. And that's really what I look for in all the clients that I work for, is I'm not just coming in to bang out this job for them and then disappear. If I do a job with them, it's because I like them and I think that there's a lot of similar interests involved. So most of the wedding clients that I've had and portrait clients, I see outside of the business world. We go to the same parties, we hang out, we have dinner at our houses. So I've built this sort of collection of interesting people over the years. And that was one of the best parts for me, doing that kind of work.
And this has been brought up on the comments on the situation post over at smogranch.com. Let's talk about the difference in being a photographer and a craftsman, all based on the photography genre. So let's say there's guys that repair shoes. They have a shoe repair shop, right? They can fix shoes. They make great stuff, but they might not make the $500 6-inch stiletto pump, but they can fix a pair of boots and they do great work. And maybe they don't want to make these high-end shoes and be famous. Maybe they just want to do shoe working for a living and they don't care about the famous part or the artsy part. So let's talk about your thoughts on the difference of being a craftsman and being a photographer.
Yep. Well, I think every photographer should have a pair of 6-inch pumps, regardless if you're a photographer or craftsman. But I think there is a difference. And like you said, some people, they don't want to be the craftsman. They just want to be a photographer. They just want to go out and make standard generic imagery, and they're totally fine. I think the big difference is, and again, this came up on the comments in the post, is I think the craftsman shoots for themselves in addition to the client. And what I see is a lot of photographers working in the wedding field tend to be using their wedding clients as their primary sounding board in terms of the quality of their work. Well, most people that are calling to get married, they don't spend their lives looking at imagery. So if you're using them as your primary sounding board in terms of the quality of your work, then consequently your sounding board to me isn't really that solid. It's got to be a little more than that. And I think that internal voice in terms of who you are as a photographer, I think that's the most important sounding board. And then it's your peers, the people that you can show the work to and say, look, is this good? Is this not good? How do I get better? And that's where the big difference comes in. When I'm shooting, even though I'm being hired by a client, or when I'm hired by a client, I'm still shooting for me first and foremost, because I want to make sure that I'm pulling myself in the direction that I think I need to go. Because a lot of times, especially in commercial photography, at least in my experience, you meet, there's this concept of what the shoot's going to be, and everyone kind of looks at each other like, you know, are you sure that's what the concept is? It's like, okay, I can do that, but I think this would be better. And so you end up saying, okay, I can satisfy the client, but then what I really want to do and what I really want to show them is this other work. And I think that's where the big difference is between people who have taken the time, and that's the key word in all of this is time. You have to figure out who you are as a photographer normally. wedding industry, you don't. You can buy a camera, build a website, and say, look, I'm a photographer, and you'll get work. But trying to find who you are as a photographer, that can take a long time. It took me 10 years to figure out, okay, I think I finally have an idea of who I'm supposed to be. It took 10 years, and then I kind of forgot for a while and dabbled around and stuff, and now I'm sort of back understanding, I think, who I am as a photographer.
So let's talk about that. Who is Daniel as a photographer? How did you actually come to even figure out what you wanted to shoot and how you wanted to convey your thoughts and your images based off of, well, let's just go take some pictures and, well, that's cool. I think photographers have such a hard time trying to figure out how to be a photographer. And I think this is one thing you're going to be chatting about here in Santa Fe. But what did it take for you to figure out what you wanted to do?
It took me not working as a photographer, which took me a while to get my head around that. But then I realized I couldn't work as a photographer and be the photographer I wanted to be because nobody wanted that work. And so it took me quitting photography and working for Kodak. And I worked for Kodak for about 4.5 years. And when I signed with Kodak, I had to sign a non-competition clause in my contract that stated I would no longer do any kind of assignment work because it put me in competition with the people that I was trying to work with at Kodak. And so I said, hey, no problem. And I signed this thing. I quit doing any kind of commercial photography. 4.5 years later, I looked at the body of work I'd created on my own at Kodak and said, wow, that's way better than anything I did working as a photographer. Wait a minute. And the light bulb went off and I thought, holy cow, this basically for me was revolutionary. I just never figured that. And so again, I'm a little slow. So I went back to working as a photographer full time. It wasn't until recently, probably 4 months ago, that I looked in the mirror and I said the same thing. I thought, wait a second, I've gone down this rabbit hole again. I'm shooting commercially and I'm shooting for all these other people, but the work that I want to do is in this other direction. So for me, I realized I can't really work as a photographer and make this work, which is a strange concept. And I would imagine to the younger photography crowd, that's probably a very strange concept of saying, wait a minute. And the thing is, that's not going to apply to everybody. That just applies to me. And so for me, it took stripping away what the industry was telling me I had to be and me realizing it's okay not to be that person. I don't need to follow anybody else. I can go do whatever I want. That's the message that I would give. A lot of young photographers I've run into in the past couple of years, they've sort of resigned themselves to these absolutes. Like, this is the way things have been, and this is the way they're going to be, and this is what I have to do. And that's just inaccurate. That's not true. You can do literally whatever you want in any way you want, as long as you're smart and you're motivated.
What did you really want to shoot? What did you want to do? Was it a specific genre? Is it a specific style? What gave you this epiphany that said, I'm doing no more portraits, no more kids, no more weddings, I'm doing my own gig? What was really the final end that said, this is what I'm doing and I'm going for it?
Well, the epiphany that I had was I wanted to do long-term black and white documentary work and I wanted to do it on my own. I didn't want to work for anybody because what I realized was, first of all, it's very difficult to get anybody to support that kind of work these days, especially in the U.S. You can apply for grants and go that route, but that took a lot of time and energy and I didn't think that a payoff would be what I needed it to be. And I gave up on the editorial world years and years ago because I realized the time and the money and the energy required to try and interest somebody in the editorial world. I figured out that if I just took that same time, money, and energy and applied it to the project on my own, I was getting better work and I was happier doing it. So I realized that I just want to do long-term black and white documentary work about whatever topic I find interesting. And I totally understand why the editorial world and the mainstream photography world doesn't have an interest because the market for this work or the audience for this work, it could be vast or it could be very, very small. And to me, it doesn't matter. I just find stuff that I'm interested in and I want to do that. I also want to write a lot more than I had been when I was doing that kind of work. It's pretty rare that a photographer does the imagery and the tech. They're typically sending people to do that, and I wanted to do more of that myself. So I'm kind of happier on an island, I guess you could say.
If people want to shoot what they want, let's say you have a love of a certain topic or a certain genre, and you just shoot that, do you think eventually that if you keep working on your work and putting honest effort into it and trying to make the best work you can, that there's so many different people that like so many different things that eventually somebody will like your stuff and you can build a following and maybe sell fine art and do work as a photographer and not as a craftsman, or you can actually make money from it?
Maybe. That's very difficult to say because this might sound weird, but I think this is another concept that I had to get my head around, is that a lot of people just don't care about photography. And that's not slighting them in any way, shape, or form. But even like some of the members of my family who I love and have a great relationship with, I don't really share a lot about what I'm doing with them because they've got a full plate. The idea of me traipsing around New Mexico working on a documentary project is pretty far down the list of what they're interested in. Today, I think sometimes what I see is I see photographers who spend so much time marketing and advertising and social networking and blasting what they're doing out across the world, and yet what they spend the least amount of time on is the actual making of the photos. So I think ultimately you have to be shooting for yourself and just realize, look, I'm going to go out, I'm going to make the best work I can, and if someone else takes an interest in this, and I'm smart, I'm motivated, and I market this the right way, then yes, you can absolutely get your work picked up. I see it happen all the time. I see young photographers and old photographers that do great projects and it gets the right exposure and things go really well. And then I see other people who do great work who just never get picked up. And that's the reality of being a photographer in 2010 or 2011 now. Jeez, getting up there.
So let's talk about your work. I mean, you want to do documentary work, but give me your exact specific work. What are you doing? What do you want to do? Really, I'm trying to figure out, okay, well, what is your interest? Do you just want to capture the New Mexico lifestyle? Is it just Americans in New Mexico? I mean, what do you like to do?
Well, the New Mexico project is my current big project. But the reality is that it's just one of the projects that I have going on, all of which, in essence, are just simply about one thing, which is telling a story. And I wrote a post a couple of days after I wrote the post, The Situation, which I think it was something like, why do this? And I was writing about why I do the blog in the first place. And the whole thing stems back to the time that I was in elementary school when I started writing things down. I started making up stories and writing them page after page after page in journals. And I still write in a journal every day. I do a ton of writing, and I basically use the camera in the same way. I just like telling stories. And for me, which is terrible for business, but I never was really thrilled by publication. I mean, it was nice to get published, but I didn't have this big high or big rush when, oh, wow, so-and-so published my work. What gave me that exhilaration was actually doing the work. And so for me, I'm happiest when I am in a place like New Mexico or Peru, and I'm working on a project. And it's the physical experience of making the photo is what gets me, not what happens to it after. But it's all wound into this idea of telling a story. So I'm shooting it, I'm writing it, and now with the ability to make my own books, I'm putting it out there in book form. And if it gets published along the way, awesome. But I'm not actively searching for magazines to publish my work. I haven't done that in years.
Let's talk about the final outcome of your work. You're an advocate for publishing, for creating your own books, to doing something with your work. A lot of people just shoot for years, and it ends up in a shoebox or on a hard drive, and no one sees it. And you've been doing a lot of work with the fine folks over at Blurb that let people publish what they want, when they want, the way they want. So how has the Blurb thing and this self-publishing revolution changed the way that you look at your photography and the work that you're doing? You're doing this big project. I think everybody should have a project. And you've been able to take these projects, and maybe they're big, but you put out different books. So there's like sub-projects within the main big project.
Yeah, the thing is, for years, I did documentary work and I never showed anybody the work. Because again, I wasn't really concerned about that. I was concerned about just making the imagery, and I wanted to have those experiences of making the imagery. And then I was with another photographer who I had at that time only known for a short while, and she looked at me and she goes, I don't get you at all. You do these projects, you do this work, and then you don't show it to anybody. And she was kind of from the opposite school, where it was very important for her to get the work out and have it seen, and just made me think. So over the years, I've sort of transitioned more. Especially when I suddenly was able to make my own book, then I thought, okay, now I have a vehicle where I can get this work out there. I started self-publishing my own magazine. Issue 2 will be started here in January. And then I do a lot of books. For example, the New Mexico Project, I just did a book from that work, but it's not a book that will be sent to the public. It's not going to be produced. It was a book that basically provided me a couple of things. One, it was to assist me when I was in the field. So when I'm out working on these projects, one of the most difficult parts is trying to explain to people what you're doing. So if you don't work for a magazine or you're not working for a publisher or anybody else, when you go into the field and you're doing doc work, people go, who are you and what are you doing? When you tell them that you're not working for anyone and no one's paying you to be there, a lot of times people are like, wait, why would you be out here doing this with nobody paying you? And so it's a little hurdle that you have to get past. So in one instance, this book is great because I can say, here, this is what it looks like, this is what the project is, and it helps them understand what I'm trying to do. Secondly, it helps me understand the work and the project. It makes me edit, first of all, to do the book. And then I can see these images printed and sequenced, and it makes me go, okay, this is what I have and this is what I don't have. So the book that I did from the project is a 6x9 softcover, all black and white book. It's got 88 pages. It's beautiful. And I look at it, and 10 seconds after getting the book, I say, okay, this is wrong. This doesn't work. This needs to move. This work's not strong enough, etc. So it's just another step in me taking this project to where I hope one day I can actually take it, which is a long, long way off. We're looking at several years before the project is going to be anywhere near where I want it to be, which might seem odd because everything has obviously in our society has sort of sped up. Time frames have shortened, and the same is true with the documentary world. I went to a show, I guess it was last year, and the photographer had spent 2 days on the project and had written in the artist statement, wow, this is the kind of work I really want to do, long-term, in-depth work. I spent an entire weekend shooting this project, and they got a show from this work, and I just looked at that and thought, wow, things have really changed. The old unwritten 10-year rule is long gone.
So talking about that, so this person did a 2-day project, and they were able to convince somebody to hang their work. Now, I don't know about you, but when I shoot, I have this very high benchmark. I just got 115 rolls of film back from the lab, and I could go through the stuff, and I don't know, maybe there's 2 or 3. I don't see how you can satisfy yourself and shoot stuff and do a 2-day gig and come out with a body of work that you can print and hang and say, wow, that's cool, man.
Well, here's the deal. You can do it. I mean, if you've got the right news event, if you've got something with an unbelievable time element, the Hindenburg going down, something like that, okay, absolutely. You've got a historical document, and in a 20-minute span, you can shoot a body of work that will go down in history as one of the most important bodies of work ever. So you have that element that you can deal with. This particular body of work that I saw was not like that. This particular body of work really needed at least a year of getting in and working to get a quality of work that should have been exhibited. But again, the quality bar differs for different people. So if you're brand new to photography, spending 2 days might seem like a really unbelievable thing. And then if you haven't looked at a lot of work and you don't know what else is out there and you haven't made comparisons of yourself compared to the top people in the field, then you might look at 2 days worth of work and say, wow, I've really got something here. I think, again, it's just the amount of time that you've had in there. For me, this little book I did on New Mexico, it's like a knife in my side every time I look at it, because it makes me realize how far away I am from this project being where I want it to be. I mean, I am light years away because I look at 88 pages in that book and there's maybe 6 images that I think will make it ultimately. So that's a harsh thing. Now, that's been the reality for me since I picked up a camera. I never thought it was going to be easy. And I think that's where today with the technology, it's very easy to shoot. You can shoot tens of thousands of images, and it's kind of skewed our perspective in terms of what's good and what isn't good. Just to give you a little side story, I had lunch with a photographer recently, someone who's been shooting for quite a while, and I brought up this concept of life images, which is kind of a title that I've given it. And it's basically if you are on your deathbed and somebody says, hey, I need to see only the images that really represent you as a photographer. And before I could finish explaining what I was talking about, this other photographer said 4. I've made 4 pictures total in my lifetime that I would show. And I thought, okay, that's really the perspective that I think I come from, and I think maybe it sounds like the perspective that you come from. But for a lot of other people, they would say, oh, that's ridiculous. I've got 500 pictures that I would show. And I think, again, if you look at what's out there and you know the history of photography, you know what's been done, and you sort of put yourself in that timeline, it's pretty humbling because there's a lot of great work being done.
There is, but it's a matter of having your standards. And I think a lot of people don't understand how to edit or even know what's good. The question is, you've been immersed in this field for so long and been looking at images for decades, and you look at everybody else's work. I think a lot of people that are fresh or maybe don't spend as much time really immersed in photography don't understand how to edit and why you should edit and what's good and what's even bad. They just look at it and say, oh, well, that's a cool picture. But if you've looked at another 150 million different photos, you can stand back at your own work and look at it and go, man, dude, that sucks.
Oh, yeah. Again, it's a humbling thing, but I got a degree in photojournalism, and I remember taking history of photography, and I hated it. I was like, this class sucks. I'm bored. I don't care. Well, looking back now, I'm really glad I took that. I also took a lot of art history classes, which I thought sucked even more because I didn't know anything about the art world. I can't draw. I can't paint. I can't sketch. It was just brutal. I took a beating in those classes, but looking back on it now, I'm like, holy moly. And now, like for me, I graduated with a degree in photojournalism, and I had never heard of Gene Smith, who I think is maybe the best documentary photographer of all time. I'd never heard of Sally Mann, who I think is one of the most amazing photographers around, and both of those people have had dramatic impacts on me. But I think you're right. The more time you study, the more you look around, the more you realize, man, the people who are the top in this field, whether you're a fine art photographer, a wedding photographer, whatever, they're really good. And that kind of work doesn't happen by accident. The vast majority of pictures that I take fail miserably. And that sucks, but it's true. And I use that as a motivating thing. It doesn't discourage me. But like you said, I've done entire shoots that I just thought, oh man, nothing, zero. I got nothing. Now the client may say, wow, great shoot, awesome. But inside, I know I could have done a lot better than I did. And some people I think are okay with that, and some people aren't. I mean, long time ago when I was interning in sort of the newspaper world and was working for different newspapers here and there, I realized as a photographer that sometimes I was going to get it and sometimes I wasn't going to get it. I would either miss it or I'd blow the moment. I remember shooting this pro baseball game and I don't know what was going on, but it was like something was happening in the dugout and all the photographers were all kind of huddled in the same area. And somebody cracked a joke or somebody was like showing a new lens or something and nobody's paying attention to the game except me. And this guy rounds third base, throw from the outfield, home plate, guy slides in, huge collision. I motor drive the whole thing and my focus was off by about 10 feet. This was pre-autofocus. I blew it, but all the other photographers heard my motor drive, looked up and realized one, they had missed it and everyone thought that I had it. And I knew I wasn't even remotely close. So, I mean, I was fumbling around. I'm a horrible sports photographer to begin with, and I just completely botched the whole thing. That's happened a million times. That will always continue to happen. Every time I go to New Mexico in the field, I blow stuff. I see moments that I'm like, oh, I should have shot that. If you see it, you missed it. And so you have to constantly be one step ahead. There was a great program on TV last night. I think it was called Crack Buried. And it was basically a show about what all the constant influx of little micro bits of information is doing to our brain. And I sat there going, yep, that's me. Yep, that's happening to me. And I thought, the residue of that, when you go into the field of work, it's right there with you. I mean, it takes me like 2 days of really cleansing myself of my normal life to get into the field and actually start working the way that I need to. And unfortunately, time these days is a luxury.
You're right. There's a bombardment of information, and I think that it's very difficult to unplug, but I think people have to unplug and sort of clear their brain. If you're going to go out and shoot, you got a cell phone, an iPhone with you, and you're getting texts and Facebook's pinging you and you're getting emails. And I mean, really the only way to clear your brain to go do something is to throw your phone in a blender and just say later and kill it. I'm almost to the point too where I want to take the TV at home and I just want to disconnect cable and just throw it in the can, man.
Well, first of all, you can do it, but it's reflected in your work. You can stand out there with an iPhone and shoot and your laptop in your bag and go back to the hotel and be on email and then go into the field and shoot and your iPhone buzzes and you can do that, but you can see it in the work. The work is fractured just like your life is when you're doing that. And unfortunately, people have to do it that way. But I realized that I can't do it. I can't do everything at once because the quality of work doesn't ever get me where I want to be. So I realized this 4 months ago, and that was one of the things that prompted me to say, okay, I need to turn a page here and I need to move on in my life. I can't be a commercial photographer anymore. I have to find a different job and I have to do the work on my own and I've got to be able to completely unplug. Because I went to New Mexico, I did a shoot and I was approached by another photographer the following day who said, how'd you do? And I was like, I have no idea. And he said, well, what are you talking about? I go, I'm so overloaded with little things on my mind. I had no idea what I was doing. And I got decent images that day, but it just made me wonder, what could I have gotten if I wasn't so fractured? And again, the next person down the line may be hearing that and saying, well, that's ridiculous. I can do that all the time. That's why it was interesting last night watching the program, because these neuro people were saying, yeah, we've sort of convinced ourselves that we can work that way, but the reality is it's impossible for the brain to function that way. you're only focusing on one thing at a time. You're just shifting between the two in rapid succession. And so that has a residual effect on your brain and the way that you take in information. So I went to visit my family over the holidays, and it's great because I've got nieces and nephews and my brother and sister and mom and everything. So I can't have the computer on. My phone barely works where they're at anyway. And so I unplugged. And I sat there one day and realized, wow, if I don't do this periodically, man, I'm going to melt down. It's just my brain's not wired to function incessantly. For example, Facebook. 3 or 4 years ago, whenever I first got on Facebook, I was like, wow, this is really fun. And I'm reconnecting with people from elementary school and et cetera, et cetera. Now I turn Facebook on. I go to the friend request things. I hit confirm, 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 and I turn it off. And it's not that I don't want to know. It's not any of that. It's just that I can't, one, take the time to do that, but two, it's sort of that chatter going in the background that I know is not helping me.
No, it's not helping, and I think you need to be able to disconnect, and I think, like you said, it's fragmentation. I think that there's so much input on so many levels. How can you go out and do a body of work or work on anything and have any concentration at all when it's just pinging all the time? It's nonstop.
Well, I need all the help I can get to make good work. I mean, I wish I could just press a button and magically go out and completely focus and make unbelievable imagery. But for me, I got to really work at it. So I kind of need all the help I can get. And I realize that sort of unplugging and taking the time to sit down and write. And typically that means writing with a pen or a pencil on a piece of paper. That's the kind of effort that I need to put in to try and get where I'm trying to go. And like I said, all of us time is look at our calendars. We're pretty booked up.
Tell me about this work that you're going to be doing coming up here. You're going to be teaching at Santa Fe workshops, but you're actually doing a class to teach people how to be a photographer. Tell me about this. Tell me about this whole concept.
If all goes as planned, I'll be teaching two workshops coming up. I've got the workshop in Peru at the end of April, which is sort of almost the same class we did last year about Peru in book form, which is shooting a body of work, editing a body of work, and then designing a book from that material, which could easily be three separate workshops. But we've put it all into one. It's over a 10-day period. It's in Peru. Last year was fantastic. I'm actually editing some of that work right now to put on my website. And last year it was a lot of fun. Peru is an unbelievable place. And in 10 days in that country, you can see a range of topics and people and events that are mind-boggling. So for me, not only is it fun teaching, but as a photographer, I'm going down to keep working on Peru as a body of work. The second workshop, actually, which comes first, it's in March, is in Santa Fe. And I've been taking workshops and teaching workshops in Santa Fe for a long while now. And they approached me about teaching another workshop, and we had talked about the idea of doing a wedding workshop, which the first workshop I ever taught in Santa Fe was about weddings. But I hadn't done one since then. They'd all been regarding documentary work. So they approached me and said, what do you think about another wedding workshop? And I said, I don't really want to teach a wedding workshop. So we devised a workshop, which I'm sort of labeling as a phototherapy class, and it's called How Not to Photograph a Wedding. And the basis of this class was the amount of people who emailed and messaged me saying, look, I'm a photographer. I shoot weddings. I've been doing this for a few years. I'm shooting all the time. I've got plenty of jobs, etc. But I'm not happy. I'm restless because I realize that there's a lot more to photography than what I'm doing right now. And I've heard from a lot of people like this over the past couple of years. And so we sat down and sort of devised a class to sort of revolve around that concept. Because the reality, I think, with specifically to genres like weddings, is that sometimes we kind of get the cart before the horse. So instead of being a photographer first, we just jump right in and we're suddenly a wedding photographer. And so this is an opportunity to basically go backwards and say, oh, look, I want to be a photographer first, and then take who I am as a photographer and apply it to whatever genre I want to do. So if I'm shooting weddings now, I can apply it there. If I want to be a commercial photographer or fashion photographer coming up, then I can take that basic knowledge, light and timing and composition, and apply it to whatever I'm going to do. And that's the basis of this class. But for me, it's a little different. I mean, it's a tricky class. I don't think this is a real popular way of looking at the wedding industry. The way that I see it, it's everything about you as a wedding photographer, and it has nothing to do with your wedding photography. So there's no brides and grooms. We're not doing posing classes. We're not all blasting away at the same thing. It's about searching personally who you are. And basically, the workshops that I took in Santa Fe, that's exactly what happened. I had story ideas in mind when I went in to take the workshop, and the instructors didn't tell me what to do. The instructors urged me and suggested things and questioned me. And what it did is it forced me to go out and find the answers. And that's what I'm hoping for in this class.
Let's talk about the work you're doing now with Blurb.
Yes, the infamous Blurb. I am officially now a part-time Blurb employee, which is a fantastic thing for me. I've been working with them for the past couple of years, doing some lectures and classes and things like that. And the people at the company are great. I think it's been a really pioneering company in terms of the digital revolution in photography, basically allowing people to tell their stories in book form, which is great. So I started working with them part-time, and I'm basically working with people in the creative field, so photographers and artists and designers and agencies, etc., just talking and working with the books, helping people when I can, and also looking for people who are using the process in the system and trying to help them highlight their work. If you go to the Blurb bookstore online and just look at the work that's being created, it's pretty impressive in terms of people around the world who have taken this to sort of help them get their voice out.
What's your thoughts about the state of the analog community? We have Kodak introducing new film. We have Fuji deleting lines of film. There's a change going on. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the change has been going on for a long time. I think the analog world is going to slowly shrink, and shrinks because people are not using it. So when a company typically discontinues a film, it's because nobody's buying that film, and it's costing them too much money to continue to produce it. So I get that. I think obviously the trend moving forward is going to continue to be everything in electronic form. I think digital is going to continue to dominate, and it will eventually all but extinguish anything having to do with the analog world. Having said that, I think at least for the foreseeable future, you're going to have people who are going to want to use analog processes, and I think it's just going to be viewed in a different way. I think you're going to have fewer options, but you'll still have good options, and people are going to continue to use it. One of the interesting things that I see is how many really young photographers are really excited about learning analog. And as one college professor, he worked at one of the big photo schools, he said, we took out our dark rooms and lost a significant portion of our student body. They transferred to schools that had dark rooms, and he said, we're having to go back and reinstall and rebuild the dark rooms. And he said, what we realized was young photographers, digital isn't new or interesting. They already know it. They were born with it in their hand, but analog isn't. So there's like this desire to go back and learn the path of where things are today and where we came from. So for me, I love living in both worlds. Fuji has this new camera coming out, which basically I was talking to another photographer earlier today about it, which I think is like the X100. And I said, that's a camera that I've been asking for 12 years. That's what I wanted. 35 F2 fixed with a finder, hopefully no shutter lag, small, doesn't cost a fortune. That's a great tool. I mean, I can use that for teaching. I can use it for taking my notes along the way. Does it mean I'm going to eliminate using film in my future? No, of course not. I'm going to use whatever I feel like using and whatever best suits my need. And I think this whole analog digital thing, the thing that surprises me is when people try to draw this line in the sand and they say, this is what you have to do. And in my experience, there's a lot of people in the photo world now that are saying you have to do A, B, C, and D. 99% of the time, they're selling something. So whether they're selling a book or an action or a disc or something, they're selling. They're telling people you have to do something because they're trying to monetize that. The reality is, again, the only thing you have to do is what's inside trying to get out. That's the only thing. Could be analog, could be digital, could be a combination, could be mixed media. It doesn't matter.
Well, I think the point is you need to work. You need to keep continuing your photographic desires. And like you said, if it's digital, great. If it's film, great. If it's analog input and digital output, that's great too. I think there's such a strong faction going on the web, and you look at all these online forums, a lot of places, that the people that are into traditional analog photography, you bring up the word hybrid or scanning or digital output, and they just want to string you up and hang you by a tree.
Yeah, I love analog capture digital output. I've been doing that for years. I think for a lot of people, that's maybe the best possible way that they could work. But I realize that most people don't think that, or they don't want to deal with that, and so it's a digital capture digital output. Having said that, I love going back in the darkroom after a 15-year break and starting to print analog again. That made me a way better photographer. I mean, I had no idea how sloppy I'd gotten in the field until I started trying to print my negatives. And I thought, oh my God, I can't print half of the stuff I've shot because it's just not good enough. And so now when I go into the field, I am way more wired tight now when I go in the field because I need those negatives to be right to be able to print them. And all the nuances of learning chemistry and exposure and agitation and all the little subtleties, I don't look at that as a hassle. I don't look at that as saying, oh, it takes too much time. That's the fun part. I mean, that's the real fun part, is knowing those nuances and saying, if I rate Tri-X at 250 and I run it in Diafine, it's going to look very different than if I run it in Rodinal. And what is this picture? What am I trying to convey? What look am I going for? And knowing all those different subtleties. For me, that's far more entertaining than sitting down in a computer with a digital file and saying, okay, I can press these buttons and sort of replicate these looks. Personally, I just don't find that as interesting. And I don't want my life to be sitting in front of a computer, but I'm 42. I know that the 24-year-old kid out there is probably like, hey, I love this. I'm not going to the dark room. I can do this quickly and I can get it online and my iPad. I totally get that. Or the older photographer who said, I spent 25 years in the dark room. I have no interest in going back. I get it. For that person, digital capture, digital prints, no problem. I think it's to each his own. But I don't want to point the finger and say, look, you got to shoot film and you got to print analog. I just don't see it that way.
Daniel, let's talk about your website where people can see your work, your pontification on photography, these great posts you're doing, the magazine, the workshops. Where can we learn about what's up with Daniel?
Well, I'm sort of whittling things down these days. So I've got two sites now remaining. One is sort of my umbrella site, which is smogranch.com. And then the second site is a straight image site, which is done with live books, and that's milnerpictures.net. And that's where you can just quickly see my portfolio. There's a little documentary film now, actually about me working in New Mexico, which is on the homepage. And those two sites will get you caught up to date. There's also, on the Smog Ranch site, it's something that kind of gets overlooked, I think, but there's a little community tab at the top. And if you're interested, you can just join the community. It's free, and it's sort of a behind-the-scenes addition to the site. So there's lots of different dialogues and conversations going on behind the scenes that are not front and center on the post. So some of the conversations that were in the situation have been carried over into the community section, and it's just a place where people can get a little more in-depth.
Yeah, this is great stuff, and Daniel, I really appreciate you joining us today. We look forward to additional opportunities to chat and updates on what you're working on and your insight. And this is great work with your photography, with Smog Ranch, and all the stuff you're doing. It's very cool.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. I love talking about this stuff. And I think anything that we can do to sort of increase the dialogue or get people thinking or talking is always a good thing. That's what these forums are for. It's about dialogue.
It's great. And again, thank you so much, buddy.
Absolutely. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
Well, there you go. The one and only Daniel Milner. Check out his website, www.smogranch.com. Daniel is a fabulous photographer. He has a unique insight in the industry, and he's an all-around great guy. Definitely check out his fabulous work, his inspirational writings, his cool books over at Blurb, and all the great stuff that Daniel's up to. The Inside Analog Photo Radio Program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine-quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shippard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.